Attention, attention all personnel. It's MASHcast.
Hello and welcome to MASHcast, the show that analyzes and celebrates episode by episode the greatest TV series of all time, MASH, which aired on CBS from 1972 to 1983. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, Corporal Captain Rob Kelly, and joining us this week in the VIP tent is Colonel Chuck Coletta. Hi, Chuck. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's great. I mean, you and I have recorded a bunch of times, but this is your first appearance on MASHcast, and we actually haven't done a podcast together in a little while, and so I'm happy to talk to you again. Now, as I mentioned, since this, you haven't been on MASHcast before. Before we get into the episode in question, which is Season 2, Episode 23, Mail Call, what's your history with MASH, the series?
Well, I am old enough to have watched MASH when it first came out. We used to watch it on Monday nights, I think at 9 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in probably elementary school and junior high, and we always used to watch it at rerun. I think it was on from 7 to 8 at night on local channel 43. We used to watch it during dinner time, and I've always watched MASH. I can't remember a time when I didn't know about MASH, but I've been a big fan right from the beginning.
I assume you watched the final episode live like most of America did at the time?
Yeah, I did, and I still have somewhere. I still have the original VHS tape that I made when it ended, so
oh,
I have
really?
That somewhere in my so I have that. And when the last MASH ended in Cleveland, I didn't attend it. I was probably too young to attend it, but they had something called the Last MASH Bash, and they had a parade or some sort of little mini parade down town in Cleveland, Ohio. And Larry Linville was there as Frank Burns, and he was dressed up as Frank Burns, and they had a Hot Lips look-alike contest. And there's actually a video of this on YouTube somewhere where you can see him kissing all these would-be Loretta Swifts.
That's fantastic. So, now, when you were recording the episode, were you editing out the commercials, or did you leave them in?
No, I just I recorded the whole thing. So it's there somewhere. If I can find it and you'd like it, you're more than welcome to have it.
I would love to see the commercials that aired. That was pretty expensive advertising rates back then. But I'd love to.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you know, those ads would probably be, at the time they were annoying and now they're vintage. So that would be kind of cool to see what was running on MASH at that time.
Yeah. Oh, and I should also mention the other thing is that I teach a class in television history at Bowling Green State University, and we do cover MASH. I've had a number of students in the last year write their icon papers about Alan Alda without being forced to. They picked him on their own, and we talk a lot about how this was a really important moment in TV history when TV really started to change in the early 1970s. And so things like MASH and Mary Tyler Moore and All in the Family, that's when, we have a lecture called the Sitcom Revolution, and MASH was really right in there, and sort of TV sitcoms, themes and issues and language really changed in just a couple of years. So it's always interesting to talk to the students about that.
That's really cool. I'd love to take that class. how much are the kids engaged in it? Or do any of them like hunt the show down on Hulu, or are they for the lecture?
Oh, no, they know it. Most of them, I think, are pretty familiar with it, especially where we are. We're 20 minutes south of Toledo.
Right.
So Jamie Farr sort of looms large in the popular culture here. And back in the 1990s, we had a sitcom conference, and he came. He was very nice, and he signed my MASH book, which I have here right in front of me.
Aww.
And there's Tony Pacos. You can come to Tony Pacos. That's still around. There's three or four, maybe five of them around town. So, come on down, and there's Jamie Farr is everywhere, the Mud Hens and so forth. All that stuff that he mentioned was true.
So. That's fantastic. If I next time I'm out in Ohio, we'll have to get together and get a bite at Tony Pacos. That would be a great photo op for the Fire and Water Network site. That's awesome. Well, that's great. That's awesome. Well, like I said, I'm happy to have you here. We talk all the time on Twitter, but we just haven't had a chance to record. So, and I'm happy to have you here on MASHcast. So, as I said, we're here to talk about episode 23 from season 2, which is Mail Call. It originally aired on February 23rd, 1974. It's written by Larry Gelbart and Lawrence Marks, and directed for the first time by Alan Alda. So the plot of this one is, it's mail call at the 477th, and each member of the camp receives something. Hawkeye gets a homemade sweater, two sizes too big, from his sister. Henry gets a package of check stubs from his wife, Lorraine, so he can balance her checkbook for her. Chopper gets a letter and a picture from his two daughters. Frank gets a letter from his stockbrokers telling him that he's now $2,000 richer than he was a month ago, all thanks to war and Frank's investments in arms manufacturing. While Frank heads off to Hot Lips' tent to share the good news, Hawkeye decides to pull a prank on him. He fakes a letter to his stockbroker mentioning a tip about something called Pioneer Aviation, which will make Hawkeye, quote-unquote, rich beyond his wildest dreams. Frank's lip quivers with excitement over the news. When he realizes the letter he's reading of Hawkeye's is missing a page, he tears up the swamp looking for the rest. Hawkeye and Trapper watch from afar with amusement. Later, Frank tells his stockbroker to sell all of his stocks and put everything into Pioneer Aviation. He tells Margaret about the news, and she immediately assumes that this means Frank will divorce his wife and marry her. Frank gives her some double talk about not being able to afford a wife and an ex-wife, and offers an alternative, setting Margaret up in an apartment near his office, you know, for lunchtime. Radar shares with Hawkeye a pen pal correspondence he's been keeping up with a young girl who thinks, thanks to Radar pilfering Hawkeye's personnel file, that he is a 6'2", black-haired captain in the Army. Hawkeye talks some sense into Radar and does a Cyrano de Bergerac by writing a response where Radar fesses up to who he really is. Meanwhile, Trapper grows despondent over not being around his daughters. He gets drunk and decides he's leaving right then and there. Hawkeye tries to talk him out of it, but Trapper is so determined he pushes Hawkeye over and starts storming out of the tent. He is interrupted by Frank coming the other way, who dismisses Trapper by saying, "I could buy or sell you." Trapper and Hawkeye decide to reveal the trick, having gotten a hold of Frank's letter to his stockbroker. They tell him Pioneer Aviation doesn't exist, and Frank storms out. As Trapper lays on the floor, laughing hysterically, Hawkeye uses the opportunity to start unpacking Trapper's hastily put together duffel bag. All right, so, Chuck, what do you think of this episode?
Well, you know, the first time I watched this again, when I knew I was going to be talking to you, I hadn't seen it in a while, and at first it seems kind of melancholy. Everybody is sort of sad, and they're lonely, and they want to go home. And then I watched it again, and I was concentrating on the jokes. There's a lot of, like, one-liners and double talk and sort of comedy routines. It's a really a good mix of sort of heartfelt emotion and sort of just pure comedy. So it's a really, I think, strong episode that where you sort of he's showing you who all these characters are and what their interests are, and you know it moves along pretty quickly. So I really enjoyed it after the second time I watched it. I liked it.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with it. It is kind of melancholy, although it opens with a very, very silly sequence where the Jeep driver comes by, presumably from I-Corps, and he throws Radar the duffel bag full of mail. And Radar, you know, the camp senses that that's mail, and they attack Radar. And in this mad scrum, after everybody gets their letters, they pull off, and Radar's clothes have been torn off. He's standing there in his undershorts and his shirt. And it's sort of funny when you think about, in later episodes, how embarrassed Radar would be at even the most slightest, personal thing being revealed, and yet he's standing there in his underpants on the floor of the camp, and he's just standing there for a full minute as they do the sort of comedy beat. He would be much more quick to run away at that point in later seasons.
Right, and that's straight out of an old sort of a Bob Hope or Milton Berle routine. I show a clip in class when Elvis is on the Milton Berle show, and they do the exact same thing. All the girls rush up for Elvis's autograph, and they pull off Milton Berle's clothes. It's the exact same thing from 20, 25 years earlier. So it's really broad, and it doesn't prepare you for the emotion that you're going to get later in the episode.
We see Hawkeye and Trapper, and they're reading their mail, and we see it's kind of funny. There's a little detail. Trapper has the photo from his daughters, Kathy and Becky, which is the first time we actually learn their names. And he flips the picture over because there's some writing on the back. And we see that clearly the photo that he's got is not from 1950 because it's in color.
No.
It looks like it's something you got at a Kmart thing. It doesn't look like, you know, a photo that you would have gotten in 1950 or 51. It's clearly pretty out of date.
No, that's right. But I like that you know, you see that these people in a lot of this episode, that they do have lives outside of camp, and they are fully developed people, and this is only a part of their life. You know, this is, they all want to hope to go home and get back to that. You know, sometimes I think we forget, well, they're a family of this 4077th, but they would all be gone, you know, the first chance they get. And I like to see that they have lives beyond Korea.
Yeah, their lives are completely, their regular lives are being interrupted by all this, and we're just seeing the interruption. But yeah, I mean, it's for as much of a cad Trapper is, along with Hawkeye, they do remind you every so often he is a married man with two children. You know, I mean, it's
right.
Like he kind of keeps up with Hawkeye in terms of the bedding down the nurses department, but he does have children. I mean, we know that Henry does, but Trapper does too. Of course, as I mentioned, we find out that Hawkeye gets a sweater from his sister, who in later seasons would be a Crisis on Infinite Earth that did right out of existence. She would no longer, Hawkeye would never have a sister as of later seasons. But it's a funny visual gag because the sweater that he puts on is like three times too big, as he refers to as having a sweater with a guest room. So it's a nice little bit. And just over the time, the writers would just be like, no, he never had a sister. And they just sort of, I don't even think they probably consciously got rid of the sister. They just forgot about it entirely.
I think that's probably right. I don't know if they used to have Bibles like this, and this is the whole person's backstory, and you know, they didn't mention her all that much. But you know, it's interesting to see when these continuity changes happen. I always like that. Chuck Cunningham, that kind of thing.
Right, exactly. I would love to have met Hawkeye Pierce's sister. Like, that's probably a really interesting person. She's probably, they wonder, did she have the same sort of smart-ass attitude that Hawkeye had? That would have been a really fun character to run into. So,
which
later
1970s
on,
actress, right? Which 1970s actress do you cast as Hawkeye's sister?
Chuck, that's a great idea. Okay, I'm going to stop the episode for a moment. Everybody's listening to this. When you go to the website, go to fireandwaterpodcast.com and leave a comment with your suggestion as to what 1970s actress would have been perfect to play Hawkeye's sister. And that we'll talk about that in the feedback episode at the end of the season. So that's a great idea, Chuck. I love that idea. I don't have any suggestions off the top of my head, but I'd love to hear everybody's ideas. That's great.
I'm going to start working on that myself. I didn't know what I got myself into. So
Perfect. So, of course, it's, and then Frank talks about that he's made more money from arms manufacturing, which, of course, Frank invests in weapons of war and is happy that he's made a lot of money off of that. That's a very typical Frank Burns kind of thing. We have the scene in the Henry's office where he gets all the receipts from his wife, where she's got she wants him to balance the checkbook. There's a comment about that she paid $236 for a vet bill for, I think he said a 15-year-old cat. And I looked that up, and that would be over $2,000 now. So that was actually a lot of money. Like, that's a lot of money for it. I mean, I'd pay it for my cat, who is right now eating her dinner as I'm recording this. But I'd pay that. But that was not an insignificant amount of money in 1951 or whatever.
Oh, no. Oh, no. No. That must be one hell of a cat. You know?
Yeah. Really, really love that kitty over there. I thought there was kind of a fun little slightly dirty joke that they got in, because Henry gets a postcard from a massage parlor, and he talks about, and it's called Madame Wank's Massage. I have to think that the censor was not paying attention that when they got that name across, because I was like, Wank? Did they really call that place Wank? But yes, in fact, they did.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I thought they said Wang at first, and I did put the captioning on to see, but it is Wank. So
yeah.
I'm sure somebody snuck that through to see if they could get it through.
they may have told McLean Stevenson, kind of like, you know, garble the word in your mouth a little so it sounds like Madame Wang. But even Madame Wang would be a little bit saucy. Of course, you could just say, well, it's the name. But nevertheless, Madame Wank, I'm like, wow, that's okay. that's a lot of crazy stuff going over there. And, of course, Henry talks about that the girls there take their shoes off and walk on your back, which of course drives Radar into spasms of excitement. He's just completely thrown by the exoticness of all this, and he kind of picks up the postcard and reads it, and he gets really caught up in it. It's dirty and very innocent at the same time.
Well, and you know, especially if you think about it, you know, in the 1950s they couldn't even say pregnant on television. In the mid 60s they were still sleeping in twin beds, you know, less than 10 years before this. And so you're doing jokes about later in the episode, foot fetishes and people walking on your back and the TV had changed.
Yeah, I'd say so. Speaking of foot fetishes, the very next scene is where Frank visits Margaret and he tells her about that he's a lot wealthier, and she is trying to seduce him by showing him these high heels that she got. And she mentions the sheer hose, and she says, well, Frank, you know, you can finally divorce your wife and get married to me. And of course that throws him off because he doesn't want to do that. And the way that she entices him is by referring to the shoes and saying, well, you know, Frank, these shoes come in clear plastic, so you can see what every toe is doing. And that just drives Frank nuts, which is like, oh, God.
And later in the episode, he's reading the Bible. So, I mean, he's all over the map on that one. So,
I find it very uncomfortable to get too far into the Frank and Hot Lips sexual relationship, and I didn't need to know that. I mean, there was another episode where Margaret talks about something and about some other shoes she got, and Frank says, I'll come over if I get to play shoe salesman. So obviously they have a lot of sexual fantasies going on involving that. And that's about as far as I want to go into that and that particular topic.
And doesn't he say something? Yeah, I'm sorry. Doesn't he say something about like he's going to buy her French bloomers or something?
Yes, French handmade bloomers. Yeah. Yeah.
Whenever those are, you know.
Yeah. A little more on the innocent side, at least on the sexual part of it, is Klinger, who brings in a letter saying that his sister is pregnant and his mother is dying and he needs to get discharged immediately. And of course, Henry does not fall for this. And this features one of the show's great runs where he reaches back and pulls out a file. And it's one of these like inch thick files full of paperwork detailing all the various letters that Klinger has tried to bring in. To convince Henry that he needs a discharge, where it's mother dying, sister pregnant, sister dying, mother pregnant, and then he says there's an oldie but a goodie, half of the family dying, other half pregnant, which is just I love that they keep all, and I love that Henry has it right behind him, like it has to be handy,
right?
Because you know this happens a lot.
Yeah, this was the routine that I remembered most out of this episode. I didn't remember it was in this particular one. But as soon as they got into it, they must have played this clip a lot on commercials or in retrospectives or something, because I definitely remember this. This was sort of the highlight of the episode for me. It was just sort of lines. You can just see Klinger is so desperate to go. You know, he'll try anything and get trucked. And Henry's sort of blasé about it. Well, you know, okay, he's let him in. He wore a nice dress to get ready for this. And, you know, he'll humor him, but he's not going anywhere.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. I love that when Radar says, you know, he's got a nice outfit on and Henry sighs and goes, if he's fussed, I say, I love
that. That's right.
He gives respect to Klinger. You're right. This scene was in the clip show from season 7, Our Finest Hour. And then it's also in one of the retrospectives that you mentioned. I forget which one. There was the one hosted by Shelley Long, and then there was the one with the group of them. So it's one of the show's great runs. And I love that Klinger can't even be bothered to keep track of the stories he's told. Like, he just writes a new one figuring that Henry won't remember.
That's right.
I think that's a really great bit. So later on, after Frank reads the letter from Hawkeye, where it's the fake letter, where he talks about, you know, we're going to invest in the Pioneer Aviation. And then we see Hawkeye and Trapper watching all this going on from the O Club, which establishes that the O Club is just close enough that you can see what's going on in the swamp, which probably isn't really true in later episodes, but it works for this moment. Later on, in the beginning of the next act, Frank wants to call home to call his stockbrokers. And there is this run between Frank and Radar about the time difference that is pretty much worthy of Abbott and Costello.
This bit
that they go back and forth, it is really genius. And just the confusion of it, where if you really pay attention, it kind of makes sense. But you also know that Radar is doing his best to throw Frank off the trail.
I was trying to figure that out. You know, I actually looked up the time zones between Korea and New York, for example. And it is pretty close, but it's all that double talk, you know, all that army double talk. And Frank tries. He tries his best. Now you're getting it, but that's a sort of a classic run, too. I really enjoy that scene.
I love when he pauses and he's like, wait, I think I got a beat on it. I love that he's trying to figure it out for himself. And then they finally get to it. And of course, there's a button on the scene where he says, okay, I finally figured it out. And he says, great, we can do it. There's a 2-day wait for the call. Which is, that's very, again, very who's on first, which is the whole, you know, that's our shortstop or whatever, that kind of thing. It's always, you always have to have, we know that Larry Gilbart wrote for Bob Hope and wrote, I think he even wrote for Milton Berle too. So, I mean, of course, this is right in his wheelhouse, this kind of, that sort of style of humor. One little detail is that Frank tips Radar, and when he tips him, he actually gives him a genuine greenback. And actually an American, you know, American money, which of course Frank should not have. They should have everything in red and blue, red and blue script. They didn't give, you know, people in the army actual money. They gave them fake money. That way you couldn't, it wouldn't bleed out into the local, the locals basically.
Oh, no.
But yeah, it's a little moment. He literally gives Radar a dollar bill and then he takes it back when Radar can't break it, of course.
Right. And yeah, he wants change, a 50 cent bribe or tip or whatever. You know, and that's why I like Frank Burns, because the world is filled with these people. And I don't think you realize that when you're a kid, maybe when you're watching it, but there are a lot of people who won't give you a stamp. They want their whatever 50 cents for the stamp. And Frank, there are a lot of Frank Burnses out there, and you have to be careful of them and watch out for them. And Larry Linville just gets it just right. I mean, he is just from the time I was a little kid, you know, you don't want to be like Frank Burns. I wasn't cool enough to be Hawkeye and Trapper, and maybe Henry I could be, but you don't want to be Frank Burns at all costs.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Yeah. He actually tries to do a nice thing by giving Radar a tip, and then he ruins it. Which is the very typical of Frank, where he's like, for one moment, he has a little bit of humanity, and then he ruins it. So the next scene is in the O Club, where we find that Trapper is getting increasingly despondent over not being around his family. He has a nice moment with Father Mulcahy, where he says, wait till you have kids, Father Mulcahy, you'll understand. And so he's pounding away on the keyboard. He mentions that he's not Catholic. Considering his name is John Francis Xavier McIntyre or something, I highly doubt that he's not Catholic.
Me too. I mean, I was surprised at that. I don't know if that was in other episodes, but he had to be Catholic.
He's from Boston, for Pete's sakes. He's Catholic. What are you talking about? So, and then in the then there's the scene in the the mess tent where Radar reveals that he has been having a pen pal relationship with this nice young girl, and he's been lying to her the whole time, and he borrowed one of Hawkeye's pictures. There's a neat little detail there where, as the camera pans over, we see Nurse Kelly and Corporal Roy Goldman holding hands. So I guess they were sweet on each other for this one episode.
Well, it gets lonely in Korea, I guess. So
yeah,
you know. She could do better, though. I think she could probably do better than that.
I think so. Yeah, Nurse Kelly is as cute as a button. I think she could do a little. She could do a little better. Absolutely. So, but anyway, I really like this moment here where Hawkeye is disappointed in Radar, and not because he is not because Radar is lying, although that's part of it. But what he's more disappointed in is that he sees that Radar doesn't think much of himself. And Radar and Hawkeye really likes Radar. I mean, he teases him, and later on in season 3, there will be more height jokes, and there will be even kind of a reckoning about that, where Hawkeye will apologize and stop doing that. But I like that it's really the theme of the scene is Hawkeye's just like, Radar, what are you doing? Like, you're a nice person, and you should just be who you are. You don't have to try to be me. And I like that a lot. I think that's very sweet.
Well, you know, I think so, too. And this shows you how TV was growing up, because that's a real genuine human moment between, you know, two adult men. And you really didn't see that on sitcoms before. You know, people were always yelling at each other, or they were doing one-liners. But there wasn't really sort of like, you know, real human emotion. Like you said, he is a little sort of sad for Radar that he thinks so little of himself. And, you know, he doesn't come out and say it, but you really feel that there's a bond between these two guys, you know, more so than, you know, Fred Mertz and Ricky Ricardo, who
right, like, right,
together. You know, I mean, that's a real moment. And you really feel like these people are people. These characters are people.
Yeah. I mean, again, when Radar and Hawkeye have a little conversation across the tent flap of the mess tent, and And Radar says, I don't have any feelings. I've just been borrowing other people's. And Hawkeye's like, no, no, you have them. Trust me. You know, and it's, again, it's really very sweet. It's like he wants, I think in a more standard sitcom, the joke would be, oh, you stole my picture. Blah, blah, blah. Don't do that. But Hawkeye doesn't even care about that. It's just more that he Radar's revealing something about himself that's very vulnerable, and I like it. It's really sweet. And Alan Alda, of course, as I mentioned, this is his first episode as director. He would later go on to direct 32 episodes of MASH, including including the final episode, of course. But, I mean, Alan Alda at this point had this part completely down, but I also have to think that as director, he's also able to sort of really focus in on what made Hawkeye such a great character, is that when, you know, you're directing yourself, you're kind of being able to see, you know, how you're going to come across best in any given moment.
Yeah, you know, and it's interesting, you know, a lot of times when actors or actresses direct themselves in an episode, they go a little light on their parts of the plot, but, you know, he's right in there with Radar, he's kidding around with Frank and this Pioneer Aviation. He's trying to help Trapper. So he's really involved. The episode's not about him, but he's running throughout this whole thing. All the plots sort of dovetail into him. So he really did a great job for his first time out.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, now that you say it, you realize that all the storylines are really everything but Hawkeye. Hawkeye really doesn't get a story. He gets the sweater, but that's just the opening gag. But the storylines are all about Frank, about Radar, about Trapper. So that's kind of interesting that, yeah, but, and you're right, Hawkeye does interact with them. Of course, he writes the letter and whatever, but yeah, it's sort of funny that he doesn't actually sort of take center stage, but he sort of is involved in all the different stories. So back at Margaret's tent, Frank has all this double talk about how, you know, well, I don't have that kind of money. I'm not a millionaire. And I mean, it's unreal how dumb Frank can be with Margaret sometimes, because he talks about how, well, I can't afford to get rid of my wife, but I'll set you up at an apartment for lunch hours. It's like, what is she, your concubine, Frank? I mean, this is like, Margaret's an accomplished, smart woman, and you think that she's going to be happy with just sort of being your side piece for the rest of her life? Like, how stupid is he?
Well, you know, and I think, you know, you did that great interview with Loretta Swift. This is when it starts to turn. Because she sees that she can do better. You know, why is she wasting her time with this guy? And he, you know, he's only interested in her because she's there. He never had any interest in making her Mrs. Frank Burns or taking her out of her army life. And she's starting to realize, you know, this is not the way to go. You know, I can't waste my life, you know, on random lunch hours on this guy. And he really is just stupid. I mean, you know, that he's so open about it, and you know, he doesn't deserve her, and she comes to realize that.
Yeah, I mean, you would think, I mean, if the writers could have broken them up earlier, and obviously they did later on in season 5, but I mean, this would really be a turning point in anybody's relationship, I would think, because the man has revealed what he would do if he could, which is basically nothing. He has, like you said, he has no interest in making Margaret the main woman in his life, and he no longer has an excuse as to, well, I can't afford to divorce my wife, but I'm just gonna, you're gonna move with me to Indianapolis and or Indiana, I'm sorry, he's from Fort Wayne, Indiana. You're gonna move with me to Fort Wayne, Indiana, and you are just going to be my sex partner, and that's it. Like, that's all that you were ever gonna be. It's like, good Lord, Frank.
Yeah, and he talks about, well, you could open a Christmas club, I'll give you $100 a week or whatever it is. And you know, I mean, boy, that he's so small. He's so small and petty, and he always makes the wrong choice.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's consistent, but he always makes the wrong choice.
Margaret does point out that she earns more as a major, and he's like, well, I can't bid against the Army. So pretty hopeless stuff. Later on, then we're back in the swamp where Trapper is getting drunk, and he has decided to literally just leave. He's packing up his duffel bag, including 5 rolls of toilet paper. And him and Wayne Rogers and Alan Alda have a really great bit where Hawkeye's a little like, is he really going to do this? And Trapper seems kind of serious. And then there's this great little moment where they're pouring a drink where Trapper says, hey, you boys in blue, you're doing a hell of a job, which I it feels like a little bit of an ad lib. And then it's a little bit of a surprising thing is that he actually hits Hawkeye. He hits him with his duffel bag and knocks him over. It's just like, it's kind of crossing a line between, I know that Trapper's drunk, but still.
Well, you know, and we know that Trapper will be gone in a year in TV time. And I always regretted that they didn't have a final scene with him, where we didn't get some sort of goodbye. Everybody else got, this is their last moment on MASH, and Trapper was just gone.
Yeah.
And this is as close as we come to that. But when Hawkeye says, well, I don't want to hit you or something, I don't want to try violence, and then Trapper, you know, doesn't deck him, but he does knock him over. And you feel that he is serious about this. And, you know, I wish that there had been more for Trapper to do. When you've been re-showing all these episodes, when we talk about these episodes, I've been watching along, and he does get the short end of the stick quite a bit. I feel sorry for that. And I wish
he does.
Stick around a season or two longer just to get some more plot.
Yeah, well, Rian Rodgers felt the same way, which is why he left, is they didn't get enough to do. But, yeah, I do wonder what – I mean, we know he's drunk, so he's not thinking it through, but I wonder what Trapper's plan here was. Was he just going to steal a Jeep and drive to Kimpo and then what, board a plane, hide in hide in the steerage department? I mean, what was he going to do? So I have no idea. And then that is the – it's in the swamp that's the culmination of the plot where we find out – that Frank poured all his money into Pioneer Aviation, and there is no Pioneer Aviation. It's all made up, and supposedly Frank is ruined. Now, at the risk of overanalyzing these plots, of course, that's what we're here for, is that makes no sense. Because Pioneer Aviation is made up. It's not a real company. So therefore, Frank hasn't lost anything. He told his stockbrokers, invest in Pioneer Aviation, sink all my money into this Pioneer Aviation. Well, presumably his stockbrokers got the message, looked for Pioneer Aviation and said, well, that's not a thing. And so Frank still has all of his money. So that doesn't, Frank is not ruined by this at all.
No, and you know, Hawkeye is just screwing with him. I understand that, you know, it's not great to be, you know, profiting off of war, but Hawkeye is going out of his way to torment this man. I don't want to say poor man, but you're right. He doesn't lose anything. He sort of, you know, loses respect in Margaret's eyes, if you want to say he loses something, but he's still got $2,000, so he'll be okay.
Yeah, you can't invest in a stock that doesn't exist. If you know, he had invested in a stock that tanked, that would be one thing. But Pioneer Aviation is not a real thing, so therefore Frank isn't any worse. So he's just not a millionaire, and so he's going to have to extricate himself from some of the stuff he said to Margaret. And as you said, it's really more Hawkeye and Trapper just sort of screwing with him and getting a laugh. And of course, it's in this moment of camaraderie between Hawkeye and Trapper that Trapper seemingly forgets all about his plot to leave, and Hawkeye grabs Trapper's duffel bag and, you know, sticks it back in his trunk, and so hopefully they'll forget all about it. And then in the button scene, we get another instance of the weird sexual shenanigans between Frank and Hot Lips, where they say out loud, where Margaret is Frank is trying to apologize to Margaret, and he says, "I'll do anything. I'll get down on my knees. I'll kiss your feet." And Margaret pauses and says, basically, be in my tent later on tonight. And that gets Hawkeye and Trapper to start laughing uncontrollably. But it's like, they said this out loud in front of the whole staff?
That's right.
Really?
They seem to think that nobody knows. In the other episodes, that they're hiding this affair that's going on. But other times, they're pretty open about it. I mean, if Hawkeye and Trapper can hear it right at the next patient, everybody in the OR must be able to hear that.
They didn't really think that one through at all. So, yeah, it's just
they're too busy thinking about their toes. So
I guess so, yeah. All right. Well, thanks, you two. So, previous episodes we've been talking about over season one, season two are the Dear episodes, you know, the Dear Dads, where we are, you know, reading a letter. And this is just the flipped version of that. Instead of following one of our characters writing home, the letters are coming the other way. And this would be something that the MASH writers would get a lot of use of. They would end up doing, I think, at least two more mail calls. I think they might have even done one more after that, sort of unofficially. But there is a mail call again episode, which we'll get to, and a mail call three as well. So this was something that the writers, I think, maybe if they had a bunch of kind of just random plots, not enough for a whole episode, they could sort of smoosh them together, make it a mail call episode, and it feels like it has some thematic through line through, you know, through the whole episode. So it's a really funny show. It's got a great line, a bunch of great lines and nice character moments for Radar especially. And as I said, it's one of the great Klinger runs, I would say.
Right.
Do you have a particular favorite line from this episode or joke?
I don't know if it's one particular line. I really did like the run with Klinger. I mean, that has to be the classic. And also when Frank and Hot Lips were talking about the difference between rich and being well off, or whatever the term that they use. There's a lot of that sort of patter, that back and forth patter that they really excelled at. Do you have a favorite particular line? Or
I do, but I do want to comment on the scene with Klinger, which we didn't mention, where all the thing with the letters, that has a great button on it too, is because after Henry goes on and on with all the letters, and he says, you know, Klinger, aren't you ashamed of yourself? And Klinger goes, yes, I don't deserve to be in the Army. It's always working an angle.
Well, you know, right, and there's another line that reminds me, the other line that I wrote down in my notes for tonight, when he says that he's a Bolshevik. They do the sort of the Bolshevik and the BS comment. You know, that was something that you wouldn't have heard it on TV before. So I did like that. Klinger, he comes in and he nails it every time.
He says, he starts calling Henry a communist imperialist dog. And he says, and Henry goes, Bolshevik. And that's when Klinger says, no, honest, which is. I didn't get that joke when I was a kid. I didn't know what a Bolshevik was. I figured it was like a nonsense word, and I just kind of went with it. And then later, as I got older, I realized what a Bolshevik was. But I was like, again, it's a good gag. My favorite line actually is when Frank is reading his letter and for the first time, and he gets excited and he exclaims like a little kid upon hearing that he's richer. And I love Wayne Rogers as Trapper deadpans. They're sending him his Captain Midnight ring, which I just love.
That's
that.
Right.
There's
another line where he's like, dull away, Frank, you know, that they've listened to this, you know, be dull, Frank. And they've listened to this guy. They're stuck with this guy in their tent. And I like the lines where they're talking about, like, Frank's lip keeps disappearing. I can tell when you're lying or your
lip disappears. It was made fun of poor Larry Linville's face. That's unfortunate.
That's his face.
You know, I mean, that's Larry Linville's actual face. So, but yeah, so it's a really solid, really funny episode. So Chuck, thank you so much for coming on the show. The strangest thing, I thought that you were on the first season, and I was like, as I was doing the notes, I was like, oh, well, we already covered Chuck's history with MASH. And then I was going through, I'm like, wait a minute, he wasn't on season one at all, so I'm so glad we finally had a chance to do this.
Oh, I'm glad, too. And let me just, if anybody's interested, I think Alan Alda's best film performance is in a movie called Crimes and Misdemeanors.
Oh, he's
Woody
great
Allen
in that.
Did.
Yeah.
He based that character on Larry Gelbart, apparently. I was doing a little research. What had happened was that they were filming the movie and the subplot wasn't working. And Alan Alda was playing basically a different character. And he and Woody Allen got together and decided to sort of change the whole subplot. And the character that Alan Alda plays in there is based on Gelbart. And a lot of the things that he says about if it breaks, about comedy, his sort of if it bends, it's funny. If it breaks, it's not funny. A lot of that is stuff that Larry Gelbart used to say. So it'd be interesting to what Alan Alda and really thought about Larry Gelbart. I'm sure they had a, you know, good relationship, but he based that sort of pompous ass character on Larry Gelbart, apparently, which I had not realized until doing a little research into it for today.
That's really fascinating. That's a great movie. That's a really great movie. And it's Alan Alda in a kind of unflattering part, you know, like he's playing kind of a real asshole, basically. And so, I mean, he's good at it. He's played villains in other pieces. It's always hard for me to kind of see that because I love Alan Alda just so much inherently that seeing him in an unflattering light is a little hard. But boy, yeah, he's terrific in that. That's great, Chuck. I had no idea. I didn't know that at all. I wonder what Larry Gelbart thought of that.
I don't know. But Rob, thank you very much for having me on this show. Keep up the good work you got. How many more seasons to go?
Now,
nine
times 24 more to go. Yeah.
Why don't you tell people you're going to be longer than the Korean War.
Yeah, that's true. Why don't you tell people where they can find you on the internet?
Well, now I am on the internet. I am at Dr. Pop Culture, BGSU, for Bowling Green State University on Twitter. And you will see where we post various pop culture and comic book related things throughout the days, if anybody's interested. So if anyone's interested, please follow me. I could use all the followers I could get. Now I'm on social media now, so I got to do that. So
that's very exciting.
So thanks for the opportunity.
Oh, you're very welcome. Always glad to have you on the show. Of course, everybody, if you want to listen to back episodes of MASHcast, you can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts or on Stitcher, or go to our website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. We're always talking MASH over on Twitter, which is at MASH477Cast. And finally, of course, if you want to support the Fire and Water Podcast Network, you can go to Patreon. You go to patreon.com/FW Podcasts. And there, if you make a one-time donation, or even better, an ongoing monthly donation, you can unlock certain rewards, like being mentioned on one of your favorite shows. And so I always have to thank the people who specifically wanted a shout-out on MASHcast, and that's Adam Sanders, Nicholas Prom, and Suzanne Holland. So thank you so much for the support and helps keep the lights on over at the Fire and Water Podcast Network. So that is going to do it for this episode. Next week is the final episode of season 2 of MASH. It won't be the final episode of the season 2 for MASHcast, but it's the final episode of season 2 of the show. So it's very exciting. We're wrapping up season 2. It's very, really fun stuff. So thanks everybody for listening. And until next week, that is all.
My investments are beginning to pay off. Before long, my ship will be coming into Easy Street.
Mrs. Frank Burns.
Where?